This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library, and our guest today is Mr. Weber Borchers. Mr. Borchers, have you lived in Decatur all your life?
Yes, I was born and raised here.
And I know you were telling me of some of the history of your family. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your family, or a lot if you can? I know there's a lot to tell.
Well, I might say that the first one of by the name of Borchers that came here was in, I think it was 1853. It was a great aunt who married Abe Kramer, who had the only carriage factory in Decatur, located at that time at the southeast corner of East Main and Franklin, South Franklin. But the first member of our family, as far as the general background is concerned, was David Hommel, and I forget the other one's name, all great-great uncles, mm-hmm. who came to Decatur before 1832, because in Mrs. Corwin Johns's personal recollections that she wrote in 1912, she is now, of course, dead. She was an old lady at the time, but she wrote them in 1912. She mentions and names the first 35 residents of Decatur, and two of my grandmother's uncles were named in that list, David Hommel and one other, Hommel, but I can't remember the given name.
Now, how did the Borchers family...
Well, we came because of the fact we had on the female side, yeah. members of the family here. My father came in 1869 or 1870 to Macon County. Mm-hmm. He came in with a Conestoga wagon. They came from Ohio, mm-hmm. where we've only lived in three places in this country, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and of course in this mm-hmm. section of Illinois. All of the family in Ohio still buried in the same cemetery, and two cemeteries in Ohio. See, one is the old Betts Cemetery, and the other one is, I can't remember that one. But they came by Conestoga wagon, and my father tells us he nearly had to walk all the way from Ohio as a little boy to join the family here.
And this was your own father who...
That was my father, yes.
But we
had members of the family on my mother's side here before that by
so
some
it was
30,
the
40 years.
Relatives who came, they yes. came because relatives
That's
were here.
That's right.
Well, now, your father evidently built this lovely home.
No, well, yes, but my grandfather,
your
too.
Your grandfather,
yes.
too. Maybe we could talk a minute about the house.
Well,
it is a very, very interesting residence.
Well, this is five generations of my family have now lived in this very house. And when I was a boy, the street out in front was this country road, and the nearest house was up at Decatur Street, which is a quarter of a mile away.
Yeah.
So there's been a big change in this area. Now this town is pretty well around us, except, of course, Lincoln Park, but it protects us from the south. The ravine in behind the house when I was a boy is where we brought our cows in mm-hmm. and our horses, uh-huh. particularly the cows in the evening to be uh-huh. milked.
So you really had almost a little farm here.
Oh, yes. Oh, uh-huh. oh yes. We yeah. we had plenty of garden
right.
and
a very different type of living
oh,
from
yes,
today.
Very much. I can remember that my mother, we used to make all our own butter, our own uh-huh. cottage cheese with our own milk. Mm-hmm. We raised nearly all our own vegetables, I would say. And we'd have a crop barrel. We still have the crop barrel and the big stone. Mm-hmm. The stone we used to press the crop down actually came from Ohio. It's out in the barn right now. See, this, we don't have a garage. We have a barn. It's filled with things from mm-hmm. the frontier.
You were showing me a record of your family.
Yes.
A big book.
Well, that's just not
a
one.
Huge
that's
the, book.
That's just one, just to my grandfather's generation has mm-hmm. there's one before that and one after that, my father's and my own. See, each generation mm-hmm. has its own I am at the head at the present time. I am the head of the house
yes.
in Borchers,
mm-hmm.
And then my grandson, in due time, will be, and we've done this. For example, upstairs is a sword, of course. It's a sword, what they call a hand and a half. It's been handed down from oldest son to oldest son for nearly 500 years.
Mm-hmm. In this book that you were showing me, which, as I said, is huge, it must be about 3 feet long, is
oh,
it?
Oh, yes.
And very thick, and it's filled with pictures, and not only pictures and newspaper articles, but articles of dress like laces and so on,
yes,
souvenirs.
Land, titles to land.
Yes.
And like the daguerreotype of copper of Abraham Lincoln
right.
sent to my great uncle from the White House in 1862. In the convention, when Abraham Lincoln was nominated for the presidency as a favorite son of Illinois, indicator. What they call the wigwam. That's behind where the citizens of the National Bank and the Millikan National Bank used to be. They put a tent up there, and they had delegates from all over the state of Illinois to nominate the favorite son of Illinois for the presidency, and Lincoln became the favorite son. Well, right here in this house, you can see it right there. Hang on, see above that, see the old part of that rail up there?
Yeah.
Now, that is one-third of one of the two rails that carried the first banners of the Republican Party in a convention. And that rail, according to John Hanks, was cut by Abraham Lincoln in 1831.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then you saw the statue of Lincoln Square in relation to
yes,
the first
right.
speech. Well, that was the time that the Lincolns lived here, mm-hmm. and 1831, and he cut rails. But it happened that Richard Oglesby, who you really would say is a kingmaker of Abraham Lincoln, went out in May the 9th or 10th or thereabouts, maybe the 8th of 1860, to the old homestead down the river from us here, and brought back a half a dozen rails. Now, I know this is in conflict with a history that says two rails, but we have here a newspaper clipping of an eyewitness, but you're not counting my own great uncle, mm-hmm. who was also an eyewitness, that there were six rails brought in. So when my great uncles, I have mentioned, had the carriage factory just catty-cornered across the street from where the wigwam was. So Richard Oglesby, when they brought the, and John Hanks brought the rails in, tied under the buggy from the farm down the river, brought them to...
Could I interrupt a minute? Were the rails a kind of... gimmick to advertise, or
I'll
explain
tell you
about
it that.
Then. Okay.
I'm trying to think of the name of the man that came in that was a carpenter that had a carpenter shop near the where the Presbyterian Church is today. Jennings,
oh.
Isaac Jennings. Anyway, John Hanks took the rails to Isaac Jennings' carpenter shop on the morning of the beginning of the convention, and they attached a banner saying something like this: Abraham Lincoln for president of the United
mm-hmm.
States. And then the convention was in session. The rails that morning, John Hanks and Isaac Jennings took the rails to my great uncle's carriage factory across the street and left him there waiting for a signal to bring him in from Oglesby,
mm-hmm.
Richard Oglesby. And when the signal came, they carried the six rails total across the street into the back door or back flap of the wigwam, and they walked to the platform that was there. They took four of the rails and threw them on the platform, which made a clatter, and everybody looked. And they held up the banner and paraded around the hall, upon which everyone yelled and shouted. And Lincoln was, of course, a nominee for the presidency of the United States. Now, immediately after the nomination, the four rails that were on the platform disappeared, probably picked up by souvenirs. But the two rails with the banner were brought back across to the carriage factory of my great uncle, and there a man from Kentucky came over and bought one of those two rails mm-hmm. of the banner, and he gave John Hanks a $5 gold piece, which is way out of proportion to its true value. But my great uncle Abe Kramer then saved this one rail, and after mm-hmm. Lincoln was actually elected president in 1860 and became president, he cut that rail into three sections and gave two sections, the end section, to friends of his, and he kept the middle section. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the middle section.
Yes.
All the other rails have disappeared. We mm-hmm. have no idea where they are, mm-hmm. but they're hanging on above the door. There is one third of the two rails that Abraham Lincoln cut in around 1830 mm-hmm. that carried the first Republican banner for the beginning of the Republican Party, which still exists,
yes.
and it's hung out in this house since 1912,
mm-hmm.
and before my great uncle kept it in his house from 1860 to 1912, and then he gave it to his nephew, mm-hmm. my father, mm-hmm. when he was elected to Congress in 1912.
Yeah.
That's the reason we have it. I might mention that the rail has been used as a gavel to open the General Assembly of the State of Illinois in the past, and has other different people that have run for president of the United States, Nixon and Eisenhower, for example, have rubbed their hands on that rail for luck.
Long history.
Nixon said, "This is for luck." I heard, because I had it in the rail.
Right.
In 1908, when my father was the first time elected mayor of Decatur, the members of the DAR came to him and asked him to have the city park department. In those days, the mayor was not only head of the police and the fire department, but also the parks. And he had appointed Frank Torrance to be the superintendent of parks. And he told Frank Torrance to go out and help the ladies of the DAR who were interested in locating the original site of the Lincoln Cabin erected by the Lincolns in 1830 down the Sangamon River. So this was done. Frank Torrance drove out with a buggy in a man or two, I suppose, and they did locate the original site of the cabin. Now, the cabin, the logs, there were four logs that were buried in the earth. The cabin itself had been taken by John Hanks and Dennis Hanks, had been dismantled after Lincoln's death, and taken to a fair in Chicago. They re-erected the cabin in Chicago and charged it 25 cents a piece for people to go into the cabin. Then we understand that the cabin was again dismantled and taken to the Boston or Philadelphia, I don't know which now, sanitary fair shortly after the affair in Chicago. And there some Englishmen, according to a rumor around here, bought the log cabin, which is all of walnut, by the way, bought the log cabin and sent it to England, where it was either lost or maybe its significance to the history of this part of the country was lost or not known, and it just disappeared. Mm-hmm. So the cabin was gone, the original cabin was gone, but the four original logs remained of the base logs. Now, those logs were all rotted except a very small fragment in one of the interior of the logs that Frank Torrance brought back and gave to my father. And many years later, we had a frame, which you see there, made of the original, what was left of the original base logs of Lincoln Cabin. So that frame is the only remaining wood left of the Lincoln Cabin of in Macon County. And in it is two Lincoln cases from Macon County.
Mm.
You see, Mrs. Hanks, Dennis Hanks's wife, lived on West Main Street. I just don't remember the number, but it's about 300 or 400 block. And when Lincoln would ride the circuit as a young lawyer, he'd have to come either in a horse or buggy or on horseback, because the courts in those days went from county seat to county seat and was a regular gala affair, so to speak. And he would sometimes stay at his cousin Dennis Hanks's home on West Main Street, what's now West Main Street. It was just a road then. And because of the nature of the weather and the roads, which obviously were not paved, just mud, he would leave the legal papers that had to do with cases in Macon County at his cousin's, and then the next round around, he'd pick them up. So Dennis Hanks, his wife, Dennis Hanks died, I don't know, remember what date, but Dennis Hanks' wife died, Dennis Hanks died, and his wife had some of the papers. Now, we had a county judge by the name of John H. McCoy. He was from Oakley Township, Macon County, and was born and raised on an adjoining farm as my grandmother. And of course, well, they were friends and knew each other. Our families knew each other for many, many years. And he knew that I was interested in history of Macon County. Therefore, he had no children that lived. And when I was a small boy, I used to go with him and walk to the courthouse, and then go on, or rather, a little over that, to the high school sometimes. I was going to high school, Decatur High, and then walk with him down there. So when he died, or before he died, he gave me the Lincoln things that he had been collecting himself. He became interested in Lincoln long ago, but shortly after when he received a license to practice law. I don't remember what day, but I'm going to say maybe 1875 or something like that. And in due time became county judge, a Republican county judge. And he bought at public auction one of the big walnut table of our from the second courthouse. Our first courthouse was the one standing now in Fairview Park, the log courthouse, in which Lincoln practiced maybe one or two cases, certainly one case. The second courthouse was a brick courthouse that stood on the southeast corner of Lincoln Square. The log courthouse, original, stood on the southwest corner of Lincoln Square. So when after the Civil War, I suppose maybe the 1880s or 1890s, 91 or something like that, they built our third courthouse out of stone. It stood right south across the street on Wood Street, across from the Hotel Orlando. When they built that courthouse, they sold some of the things in the second courthouse, the brick courthouse. And Judge McCoy bought one of the large walnut tables upon which was used in the county court at the time that Lincoln practiced law on the judicial circuit. I have that in my possession. It's in a warehouse right now, and I shouldn't do that, but I have that in my possession, plus some of the original cases that Judge McCoy got from the wife of Dennis Hanks. That is Lincoln's original copies of his cases in Macon County. Now, during the WPA days, I believe that most of the Lincoln signatures and cases were stolen out of our county records and are gone.
Oh.
Now, let's see. To continue on the cabin. Now, We have a reconstructed Lincoln cabin on the Sangamon River.
It's a park, isn't it, now?
But it's not at the right spot.
Oh, it isn't?
Oh, of course not. Well, now, can you imagine? I can imagine any of my grandparents or great-grandparents allowing their men to build a cabin on the top of a hill that's practically straight down to the nearest water, 30, 40 feet down, and having to carry up water for washing and drinking from such a place. Well, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. Actually, the cabin that they located, I don't believe the spring is there anymore, but there was a spring long ago, and that cabin was built on this supposedly never-ending flowing spring. Mm-hmm. And and in 1908 or 19 somewhere or other, the DAR had a boulder placed at the original cabin site. Now, that boulder is still there. It's not the boulder. Mm-hmm.
Is
that
it
you
nearby?
See there now. Pardon?
Is it
oh,
close?
It's rather close, maybe a quarter of a mile away.
So you could see
well, it's still
the
there with the bronze plaque on it. It's it's still there, but it's not. It's I think that Gary Johnson owns the land now, and I think that he has stated he will not permit anyone to move the stone to where the reconstructed cabin is. And I don't blame
him. No,
after all, he's got the original site, and that's the original stone with the original marker of the dead Daughters of the American Revolution. Why not leave it there?
Uh-huh.
The other's all right for all the people coming in.
It gives a kind of picture of
yes, that's right.
Probably what it was, almost what it was like anyway.
Well, in any case, you can understand that no woman or man in their right mind is going to build a cabin where they have to haul water up
and down the
that hill.
Mm-hmm.
All you got to do is think about it.
Uh-huh.
Well, my Aunt Myrtle, who died just last February, 98 years old, her husband was Reverend E. Miller, and Reverend E. Miller's brother married, I don't remember, one of the Hanks girls. And so I have talked and listened to some of the stories of the Hankses through my aunt's, I guess that'd be niece, or something like that. And I hope that if any Hankses hear this part of this story, they will forgive me and not go gunning. But I have, it has been inferred to me that John Hanks liked his liquor. Now, it happened that when they took the cabin up to Chicago and charged a quarter, I have been told, alleged to me, that most of that money that John Hanks received was drunk up. John Hanks was quite an entrepreneur. I might tell you that in the libraries and the archives of the state of Illinois is an actual letter written by Richard Oglesby, and I won't quote it exactly, but I sure know the meaning of it, along these lines. John Hanks, after he got $5 for the rail right after the convention in Decatur when Lincoln was nominated, John Hanks went into the business of selling rails. And the old-timers, I've heard this from my grandparents, said that actually he sold them all over the country, the east, the west, New York, clear out to San Francisco, to the west, at a dollar a rail. And it's rumored that there wasn't hardly a rail fence left in the west side of Macon County after John Hanks got through. And there is a letter, which I have seen, something like this in the archives, that's written by in Richard Oglesby's handwriting that says something like this, that Richard Oglesby, did all the writing, all the corresponding, and John got all the money. And I thought that was
he had a good deal there.
He had a good deal there, and Richard Oglesby rather complaining. I want to say something about Richard Oglesby. Now, Richard Oglesby was without doubt a kingmaker, and he was the one that conceived the idea of the rail splitter candidate that became the slogan for the Republican Party in the first election of the control of the White House. And Richard Oglesby, by being the kingmaker, has never been properly, in my opinion, recognized by this community. I do not agree that Richland College should be called. I think it should be called Oglesby College because of the history. a historic background. Mm. Not only was he the kingmaker, the man behind the scenes to cause the election of a president of the United States, but he was also a very civic-minded Decatur man. He, of course, like many people at that time, emigrated, I think, from Kentucky to Decatur, mm-hmm. as I recollect, about maybe 1840 or thereabouts, and I'm just guessing that. The record will show that. He became a colonel of one of our five regiments, Decatur, Macon County, founded or formed five regiments in the Civil War. We have an outstanding mm-hmm. Civil War record. We also have five generals in the Civil War. One of them was, Pugh, Oglesby. I don't know whether Packard was or not. Loeb. I can't recall the other two mm-hmm. at the moment. I have to look at the histories to get that. But we had five generals, and Oglesby was wounded through the lungs, leading the charge of the 8th Volunteer Illinois Infantry, mostly from Macon County. Nearly died of his wounds. Recuperated here. Lincoln made him a adjutant general, as I recollect. But he did become not only a member of the Oglesby, not only a senator, but a state legislator, I think. He was also the only man in the history of Illinois to be elected three times governor of Illinois. So here mm-hmm. we have a United States senator, I think it was. Mm-hmm. United States senator, a governor three times, and a brigadier general, wounded in action, theoretically the Purple Heart, an outstanding citizen, and I don't think we have anything but his home, which has been properly mm-hmm. preserved by the efforts of Lindley Hurt.
Yeah.
I want to say something else about John Hanks. Now, John Hanks, when Lincoln became president, John had visions of glory, I mm-hmm. think, because he wanted to become high up in the army. But Lincoln, of course, knew John Hanks. So, and John Hanks, as I recollect and remember, even went to Washington, to the White House, mm-hmm. to get that appointment. Mm-hmm. But John Hanks didn't make it. He mm-hmm. ended up as a wagon master, driving a wagon of supplies in the Army of the West, or the Army of the Cumberland, mm-hmm. I suspect.
A little different from
yes.
being...
Well, John couldn't read or write. Well, that's another thing I might mention, because indication of that is the fact that Richard Oglesby has said in his letter that he had to do all the writing and
yes.
John took all the money. That backs it up. I think all he could make was his X. If I'm wrong, I hope I don't get shot. I think it would be interesting to tell something about the so-called Lorton Brothers Trading Post, which was located where the spring French Creek runs into the Sangamon up in French Creek Township. When I was at the University of Illinois, I chose my thesis, the history, pre-white history of this area, Macon County, of course. And I discovered that the Lorton brothers that my grandfather had talked about, that was not their name. It was Lortonnerie. They were French. They were French traders. There was Antoine Lortonnerie, and I don't remember the name of the other Lortonnerie. It's probably somewhere in history. But I did locate in Quebec, in the records of Quebec, Canada, I did locate a record of the King's Trading Company. That is a trading company. Of course, under the Treaty of 1763, Canada had been ceded to England and became English. But under the king's, under the authority of Louis XIV, King of France, a trading company had been set up that had the right to give trading areas. Now, in the rivers, since there were no roads and the rivers were the roads, it was river valleys. And I located a grant to the Lortonnerie dated in 1802 for them to create a trading post The Midi, Les Rivières, Sangamon, stands to reason. It's our Sangamon River. And when you look at a map, you'll see the Midi of the river, Sangamon, is about right where Friends Creek runs into the Sangamon. Now, in Smith's history, that's the first history ever written of Macon County, and I think Mr. Smith printed it about in the 1870s or something like that. I'm sure our library has a copy of it. He stated that the Lorton Trading Post, that the Lortons left and went north when they abandoned the trading post in 1816. Now, this doesn't jibe at all. My grandfather has said that he remembered that older people in his time said that as high as 500 Indians came to trade at this trading post. Now, so I suggest that when you have, if that is so, that you don't have 500 Indians come practically in 1 year to a newly established trading post, because under Smith, it was established in 1816. But I know it was established at least by 1802, and I'm sure it was older than that. Because, and there's another interesting thing. When in the old days, my grandfather, when he talked of Indians, he didn't talk of Indians in the sense of women and children. 500 Indians to him meant 500 warriors. So that could maybe mean five times that. So I don't know what the situation is there, except I am sure that the Lorton Brothers Trading Post was not English. Another thing that backs this up, or American, another thing that backs this up, they went north. Now in 1816, the Kickapoo, who lived right here, had just ceded in the Treaty of Greenville the Kickapoo lands in this part of Illinois in 1816. Well, if the Lortons were American or English, well, they might have got away with it English. But the Lortons, if they were American, certainly would not have gotten away with it. They'd have lost their scalps because the Kickapoo furnished their warriors during the War of 1812 to the British to fight the Americans. And it was the Kickapoo who led and perpetuated some of the raids on the Kentucky settlements that helped make Kentucky the dark and bloody ground. Along with, and they were allied for war with the Shawnee, the Miami, and I have two third cousins that are part Miami Indian, and I know something about that, or have heard about some about that. So, and not only Shawnee, but the and the Miamis, but the Mingo, and the Wyandot, and the Potawatomi, all went against the settlements. I would further state that another reason why they would not have been American was when they abandoned the post in 1816, they went north. Now, that was the direction of Canada, where the French were, and under the trading charter of the King of France. And, of course, the carried over by the English. Now, at that time, there were no real trails over this country. You had to go by rivers, and to go back east, if they had been American, they'd have had to gone down the Sangamon River to the Illinois, then down the Illinois to St. Louis, and on up the Ohio, or take an overland trail from St. Louis through southern Illinois, perhaps. But I'm sure that they had nothing to do with the being American. I'm sure they were French. Around 1900, 1906, 1910, 1912, the population of Decatur was about equal to the population of the county. So there was a sort of equality there that no longer exists. Politically today, Decatur has over 90,000 people, and the county doesn't even come half of that. So the political power has switched from the county to the city. It used to be, of course, the county. So it used to be the county people that elected the people to the legislature. For example, my great uncle Harmon Manicky was elected state senator, and then he was just from a small area of the county. But because being a farm background and a farmer and Civil War and all that, it was possible for him to be elected. Another example is my Aunt Leona Bowman. Mm-hmm. Now, Aunt Leona died just a couple of years ago at 98 years old, mm-hmm. nearly 99. The same as Aunt Myrtle died just last February, nearly at 98 and nearly mm-hmm. going on 99. Mm-hmm. Very long lived. So the point that I wanted to make is that Aunt Leona, being from the county, all my aunts taught school, obviously a county family, very well known throughout the county, not near so well known in Decatur, but well known in the county. And we decided, rather not I wasn't even born then, but members of our family, like Uncle Harmon Manicky and my father, Charles M. Borchers, were in had to be in politics to protect ourselves, decided that they were going to run Aunt Leona Bowman for county superintendent of schools, and they did. Not only did they...
A woman?
Yes. Not only did they run her, but she was elected in 1906.
That's county amazing.
County superintendent of schools, and at that time, women didn't have the right to vote. So here she was elected, the first woman possibly the first woman ever elected in the state of Illinois to a county position as county superintendent of schools, and she couldn't even vote for herself. But she was elected, and she held that position,
and
if you care to look at the records. And she did a very good job. She later on went up to teach and got her doctor's degree and taught as head of the Department of Home Economics at one of the universities in Ohio, and I forget which one right now.
Amazing.
So it goes to show you what could happen. I doubt if a non-city person could necessarily be elected today under those kind of situations. I think it'd be interesting to know how what happened right after the Battle of Shiloh. So I recollect it was in 1862 that the Battle of Shiloh was fought, and the Illinois Central Railroad line run directly through Cairo, Illinois, the Battle of Shiloh, Cairo, Illinois, and right through Decatur to Chicago. Mm-hmm. So we have, and I think that I gave a copy of it to the library, a record of the Long Creek Ladies Aid Society. That may not be the correct title, but it's the idea. Mm-hmm. We received in Macon County a notice of after the Battle of Shiloh of trainloads of wounded and prisoners being brought on the Illinois Central Line to Chicago, passed through here, and they came. Many, many trainloads of these type of people. Mm-hmm. One trainload was a trainload of refugees. And these refugees were Kentucky Back Hills people. Mm-hmm. The record shows, and we have a copy somewhere in the house, but the library, I'm sure, has a copy of it, tells a description of these people. The women, of course, were smoking pipes and chewing tobacco, and they were spitting tobacco everywhere. The children were filthy and lousy. And the women of the Long Creek Ladies Aid Society helped clean them up and brought in to feed them. And a lot of them liked it so well, they dropped off and stayed at the stay in Decatur. Now, we have some of their descendants to this day. Now, I'm not going to say some of their names, because, again, I might get in trouble. Some of those people have been on, theoretically, welfare since the Civil War. Sorry to say. Others have done very, very fine. I want to say that, too. But I want to tell you why. The Oklahoma district. Now, that the Oklahoma area is the area north of where the Red Cross building is now on Lake Decatur. Mm-hmm. Now, this, of course, is long before Lake Decatur was built. So they got its name, the Oklahoma, because of the events that always seem to happen. Now, on East El Dorado Street, which they call the Levee at that time, near where the Wabash Railroad Station is, They had so much trouble they had to put a special lock up, because that was the troublemaking spot. They had houses out there in the levee, and they had, of course, plenty of taverns or saloons in those days. And it was wild and woolly. And according to the stories of the times, every time there was a fight or goings on, and there was an arrest to be made, nearly half of them would come from what they came to call Oklahoma. That is this area that is just on the north side of the present bridge by the dam. Now, that's the old Oklahoma area. There were four plats. Number one, two, three, and four. The only ones that are left are one and two. Mm-hmm. Number three is underneath the road, the state road network that runs down to the bridge. And number four is under the lake.
Oh.
And that's where they settled, putting up little shacks and one thing and another, and so it was for a long time. So the Oklahoma Territory received its name from the Oklahoma Territory at that time, where all of the Dalton gang was riding, and the Indian, it was Indian Territory, and all the trouble was going on in Oklahoma. We had so much trouble here that they call that area Indicator, the southern part of Decatur, Oklahoma. I had a total of six great uncles in the Civil War, and most of them would come right to where we are talking right now in this room. Of course, that'd be before World War, or during World War One, or right before World War One. They were all alive then. Mm-hmm. And they would tell stories. I remember a couple stories of the Civil War. One was my great uncle William. No, great uncle William. Yeah, he was with one of the Ohio infantry regiments, the Army of the West, or the Army of the Cumberland. And at the Battle of Chickamauga on a ridge, he belonged to what was later on they called the Iron Brigade. And he was shot through the knee with a mini ball, what they call him. And he lay early in the fighting. And so his friends, there was a lot of oak timber and hickory timber around, so that his friends hauled him and put his back up against the one of the big oak trees, so the balls coming in from the Confederates, the rebels, wouldn't strike him. And the rebels charged and took the ridge and drove the Union forces back. And the times, I guess, were different in those days, because when the rebels reached the tree and found him on the side, and the Yankee bullets were coming in his direction, they hauled him around and put his back against a tree so he was protected from the Yankee bullets. Well, they in turn were driven off, and the bridge was retaken. So they hauled him around again, put his back to the tree again. And again the rebels charged and took the ridge, and they did the same. And the last time the Yankees kept it, and so it became all right, but he was set off, and he carried the scars of that until he died. Mm. Now, my great uncle Henry Borchers, we've all been cavalrymen. I'm a cavalryman. My brother's a cavalryman. My father wasn't a cavalryman, but I might say that when the Spanish-American War came along, that he was elected, as it did in those days, the first sergeant of a company of infantry that was raised by the Durfees. I don't remember his name, he's dead now, but the Durfee Clark and Nicholson insurance company in those days. But Durfee raised a regiment indicator, and he was elected first sergeant. However, they never did, were never called, so they didn't get into the Spanish-American War. So he was the outcast, not a cavalryman, all the rest had been cavalry. Anyway, my great uncle Henry Borchers was with the 11th Volunteer Missouri Cavalry, and again in the Army of the West, the Siege of Vicksburg, and all of these kind of things. And one day on patrol, I think this is probably in Arkansas, in the vicinity of the Mississippi River, and the thickets along the Mississippi, and some ridges. They were going up a ridge. They heard the rustling of some brush. Mm-hmm. And the patrol instantly stopped because they thought there might be an ambush of Confederate forces there. And they moved very, very cautiously towards this to see what the rustling was. And everyone was on alert, I suppose, with their tongue in their mouth, or ready to jump or flee or whatever, or take cover or whatever. And here a black bear cub came up over the ridge towards them, that's when they found out it wasn't necessary not to worry about it. It was just a bear cub instead of a Confederate unit waiting for them up there. Now we have right in the house here the drum and the bugle of the 116th Illinois Volunteer Infantry. Now that drum and that bugle was carried by the 116th through the entire Civil War, and that is one of the regiments, one of the five regiments that were mostly composed of Macon County men. And Colonel Tupper, who's buried over here half a mile away in Greenwood Cemetery, was shot through the lungs at Ball's, as I recollect, Ball's Bluff, leading a charge of the 116th against the rebel lines there. He died as a result of that wound. Of course, he's buried, as I said, over here in Greenwood. That drum, that bugle, went with the regiment through the entire Civil War. The bugle was used for every call, from retreat to, in the evening ceremonies, or attack, or a pay call, or mass, or taps, or whatever. And it's rather beat up, but it still can blow. Mm-hmm. And the drum and the bugle were carried by our own soldiers, for sure that I know of, Chickamauga, Kennesaw Mountain, the Siege of Vicksburg, Battle of Atlanta, other battles that I don't remember at the moment, and then was carried the last time before the discharge of the regiment in the grand parade in Washington, D.C. after the close of the war. The regiment, of course, is one of the 50,000 men under Sherman that mm-hmm. made the circle through the South. In the family records, we have a invitation to a dance in honor of the Confederate General, General Joseph E. Johnson. Now, General Johnson was the commanding general of the Confederate forces of the Confederate Army of the Southwest. The reason we have this invitation is my great uncle Henry was on patrol again, and his group captured a Confederate officer, and this Confederate officer had this invitation to the dance on him. He also had a little bit of Confederate money and the railroad tickets, I presume, to go to the dance. So my great uncle Henry confiscated the money, the tickets, and the invitation to the dance, and we still have them. However, I have an idea that he did not use them, because that would not have been very good judgment on his part, but as a Union soldier to go. Born and raised in Fairfield County, Ohio. He was the one that determined to come west to settle in Decatur, where some of his family had preceded him, one sister and some of his great aunts had preceded him to the area of Decatur. But before he settled in Decatur, he went to the gold rush in California about 1852. Now the gold rush started, I think, it was 1849, but he did not go right away. He went with his brother Henry Borchers a few years later. They traveled across the plains and landed in California. They found that the prices were high and the gold so little that they determined to come on back. But he did bring with him, and we have a small locket with a crystal on both sides, and inside this crystal locket is a pinch, a place of gold that he had made into a locket for his mother when he returned on the from California. Now, when he did bring his family, that is my grandmother and my father and my aunts and my uncle, to Macon County and to settle here, he became, in due time, interested and a friend of E.A. Gassman, for whom Gassman School is named. And the two of them were greatly interested in ornithology. So my uncle, my grandfather, and E.A. Gassman would go into Macon County and hunt and shoot the specimens of birds that lived in Macon County, either as migrants or permanent residents or winter residents. So right in this house, right now, are the mounted birds that my grandfather had mounted, shot and mounted with E.A. Gassman. Of all of the birds, we have over 200 of the various species of birds that occur in Macon County. Now this was all done somewhere in the 1870s, 1880s, and before 1900. And we have them here. And right now in the basement, in a case, is three pasture pigeons. Now those pasture pigeons are now extinct in the United States. We have two male mounted male pasture pigeons and one female. And one of the most remarkable things is we also have one pasture pigeon egg. Now my grandfather has told me, see, he died in 1918 when I was about 12, 13 years old, and I used to ask, and he'd tell me a lot of the various stories of the frontier and all this kind of thing. And he told me that the pasture pigeons came in such flocks that they would actually darken the sky, that a flock would be going by for hours, and they would settle in a huge area of forest land in Macon County. And what they would do in those days, and I suppose elsewhere, they would build, at nighttime, the birds would roost and they wouldn't fly. They'd build big bonfires and then they'd throw brimstone or sulfur, and the fumes of the sulfur going up into the trees, and the trees would be absolutely loaded with pigeons, just loaded, every branch, that the boughs would be bending down, that the pigeons would, with the brimstone, the fumes of the burning sulfur, would fall in hundreds and hundreds, and they'd pick them up by and put them in sacks to either sell or feed to the pigs as not as fertilizer, but as food for pigs. And I think that is something that may not be remembered anymore, but this is how they did it, besides the shooting. It's as a result, all the pigeons, the pasture pigeons, and that was the only true Native American pigeon, they're all extinct now. I suspect we have more mounted pasture pigeons than the State of Illinois Museum has. It wouldn't surprise me, because how many people, even the museum, has sparrows? They were so common you don't think about it. But if they became extinct, well, then it'd be something to have one. Perhaps I ought to have you walk down and take a look at the collections, all in light cases in the basement. My father, of course, was born in Fairfield County, Ohio, and came on foot across the river, Wabash River, as I recollect them telling about it, at Crawfordsville. I think it was Crawfordsville. So he grew up, went to school. We settled in Oakley Township, where we still have land. And he went to the Berry School in Oakley Township. And he worked on the farm and for other farming families in Oakley Township. And then he decided he was going to teach school. So he taught in many of the old country schools of Macon County before 1800. And then he decided he was going to study law, become a lawyer. So he engaged to study law under Albert Weber the First, who was one of the old lawyers of Decatur, Illinois, just after the Civil War. That's why I have my name, Albert Weber, because I was named, he was my godfather. And I was named for him because my father always admired Albert Weber. Then When he began to practice law and decided to go into politics, he ran for mayor of Decatur in 1908 and was elected mayor of Decatur. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason he ran was Decatur was a very wild town. It was filled with saloons. We had over 100 saloons in Decatur at the time, and we only had a population maybe 11, 12, 13,000. It was a real drunken town, mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say. So the ministers and the churches, Catholic and Protestant, under Father Murphy, who I ought to tell something about him, and Reverend Penhaligon and others, all joined together to support my father if he would close down the taverns and clean up the town. Well, he was elected, and he closed down all the taverns. This town was dry. Fact is, I don't remember, but I remember the story that a group even tried to kidnap me to force my, and actually grabbed me and then dropped me because my baby nurse yelled out of a window and saw them, and they were getting ready to put me in a horse and buggy and gallop away, I suppose. Mm-hmm. A thrilling adventure, as you can see. But I don't remember a thing about it. But he did close down the town. Mm-hmm. Well, he did such a good job of that that in 1912 he ran against McKinley for governor. I mean, for Congress of the district. And although
United States Congress.
Yes, United States Congress. And although McKinley had been many terms in the White House and was the president of the Interurban Line and had a great deal of money to spend and a lot of political power, my father defeated him in a very hot battle and was elected to Congress. In 1918, the Staley Company, but in 1917 or thereabouts, the Staley Company, the river would go down dry. The river right down here would go dry nearly every August, and sometimes it's up into October, November. And the Staleys would have to close down the Wabash Railroad shops that took care and serviced all of the steam engines at the time. Couldn't get any water, they had to close down. And the Staleys actually bought land on the Illinois River near Peoria where they had permanent water supply and was getting ready to move. Well, it became imperative. That had been the death of Decatur. Mm-hmm. So my father called first a meeting of members of our family. You must remember, we all really are a land farming family. Mm-hmm. And we have land all the way around Decatur and Pike County and Smolten County. And for the loss of our, that time they didn't raise soybeans, it was corn. And the loss of the corn of our near corn market was not to the best interest. So my family encouraged my farming family, my uncles and aunts, encouraged my father to run for mayor on the proposition of building Lake Decatur. Mm-hmm. So on May the 30th of 1918, and you of course see the bronze plaque on in commemoration on the fireplace, my father called a meeting of the important leaders of Decatur at that time to our home. Now, as I remember, there was a country road out in front, and we were all in the city, but it's still unpaved. I was just a small boy, but I remember the cars coming down, the big old cars and the dust of flying. Mm-hmm. I do remember the names of some of the people that were here. There was A.E. Staley, the senior. There was a fellow from the Milliken Bank by the name of Brownback. I think he was the vice president of the Milliken Bank, Brownback. There was Jim Allen. Jim Allen. There was also Horace Bering present, Robert I. Hunt, and Mr. Hardy, who was one of the editors of the Decatur Herald. There were others here besides those that have already been named, but I just simply can't remember them any longer. Now, at the meeting, it was determined that if my father, who was an attorney, had been, of course, an ex-congressman, would run for mayor and build the lake, they would support him. Now, at that time, the salary of the mayor was $3,500 a year, as I recollect, or thereabouts. And that would be quite a loss in relation to family finances. But he felt that since Stades was actually had bought land in Peoria on the Illinois River and going to move, that was the necessary to save Decatur, it was to build a lake, because we had to have the water. The Decatur could not expand in the future without a lake. So he agreed that if to run on the proposition and the platform of building Lake Decatur, if they would support it, which they agreed to do. And he was elected. So he began the process of building Lake Decatur. They had to buy the land, and incidentally, I think the land probably cost less than $1 million. Well, the whole dam, as I recollect, cost around, land and all, it cost around $3 million. Mm-hmm. Now, my father conceived the idea of forming the Decatur Water Supply Company. The stock of this company was sold to the people of Decatur and our own banks. All of it was sold. I was carrying papers at the time, and I remember I even bought a $100 bond myself with my paper money. That was a lot in those days. And they had the money to finance the dam. Now, the board of directors of the Decatur Water Supply Company was leading citizens of Decatur who served without pay. In fact, as everybody served without pay. The lake was started, I think, around 1920. I don't remember those dates, but around 1920. By 1923, nearly 1924, it was the dam and the lake was cleared of timber, the dam was built, and the water impounded. The first man-made lake in the state of Illinois of this size. Had a big celebration in 1924. I remember going to that celebration. It had been suggested that they name the lake Lake Borchers, but my father said that he didn't want that and refused to have it done because it was Lake Decatur, as it is now. And about night, even though the Depression came, one of the things that this company did, my father went to the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois, and one of the things he got permission to do was to have the city waterworks and the dam and the lake and all the water revenues, everything that had to do with water, turned over to a civilian operated, not a government operated, civilian operated company, the water supply company, Decatur Water mm-hmm. Supply Company. And this was done by the proper handling of the finances of the lake and the water, the city of Decatur, the control of the meters and all that. And although the Depression had come in 1929, about 1932, at the last meeting of the board of directors of the Decatur Water Supply Company, they gave us a gift. Before they disbanded forever, they gave us a gift, the title to the lake, the dam, and turned back the water supply company, the city waterworks, Decatur Waterworks, to the people, and they own it to this day.
And that's been a great asset for Decatur.
Oh, yes.
Kept Staley's ear.
Oh, yes. And the Wabash, the railroads, and everything else. I would like to mention, since we have talked about Staley's, I'd like to mention the Mueller Company, which grew out of the inventive genius of Hieronymus Mueller. He was originally in the gun making business, and turned into plumbing. And out of that, now they have plants. I believe there's one in Canada and one in Tennessee, and they have plants and have for many years been in the plumbing producing units for plumbing, and they have a certain kind of valve. I don't know anything about it because I have nothing to do with the Mueller Company, but they have a type of valve they have the patent on that was very successful in relation to selling to cities and so on. I also want to mention that I forgot that Adolf Mueller, I think he was the son of Hieronymus Mueller, was also at the meeting in my home here with my father when the decision was made to build Lake Decatur. Some of the people of interest that my father introduced at meetings in Decatur, in Central Park, or in Lincoln Square from the old transfer house were, Marshal Foch, commanding general of the French Army during World War I, General Pershing, commanding general of the American Army in World War I. Also, when Byron, I think it was around probably 1908 or earlier than before World War I, when Bryan, who was running for President of the United States, came to Decatur, he introduced him from the platform on the top of the transfer house in Lincoln Square to quite a large crowd. We have a picture of that somewhere in the records. And I know that he was at the dedication of Millikan University, of course not as mayor, but as a citizen. We have in the records when Teddy Roosevelt came to dedicate, give the speech and talk of dedication at Millikan University. We have one of the programs in the records of that. I remember that we have that. And he was a very good friend of Uncle Joe Cannon, who for many years was Speaker of the House in Washington. We have also a record of a dance in the White House. We have quite a few invitations to affairs in the White House. One of them was a dance in the White House, where we have the dance program of my aunt Emma Borchers, who danced with Uncle Joe Cannon at one of the dances in the White House. There's so much of the stuff we have like that I really don't remember it all. But my Aunt Emma Borchers worked for many years in Washington in the Department of the... I want to tell about Aunt Emma in World War I, come to think about it. There were just 5 women who were entrusted in World War I with the secret codes of and the intelligence codes of the between the War Department and the American Army in France, General Pershing. And she was one of the 5 girls who were entrusted with the codes for translating the messages from the army in France to the United States, and we have in our records still her copies of the secret codes of the United States Army of World War I. After she worked for the War Department, she then became a man, and the war was over, she was transferred to the Department of Labor Statistics, and that's where she retired from some years ago. She also lived long. She was nearly 100 years. She died in 96. And she ended up as the 5th ranking member of the Department of the Labor Statistics of the federal government.
Quite a record.
I went out for football at the University of Illinois and my right ankle got broken by Garland Grange, the brother of Red Grange, who was playing at the time in practice.
And what time was this?
That was probably 1927. Mm-hmm. I was playing right end. No, I was playing left end, because I blocked in. I still don't remember what happened. He came around and caught my ankle and broke it. That put me out there, so I have always been interested in Indian history and Indian affairs. And so I want to tell about Chief Illiniwek and how it came about. In 1926 or 27, Lech Lutweiler, a student at the university, at the Pennsylvania game that year or the other, had a turkey feather outfit, and the band went to the Illinois-Pennsylvania game that year. The first time the Illinois band had gone to the East. and we skunked them, I might say, and we impressed them with our band. Well, at this, between the halves, Lex put on a Indian dance in front of the stands, and it went over big. So he came back to the University of Illinois, and for several times he put on the dance at the University of Illinois. And then he graduated in 1928. And I saw this, and I majored in history, got my degree there, and I thought that this was something that would be appropriate with the name of the state, Illinois, or Illinois, the pay of the Illinois, the land of the Illinois. It could be all tied together in a good tradition for the university. We had no symbolism at that time. So I went to Ray Dvorak, who was the head of the marching band, under Professor Harding, who was the head of the band, and I proposed to Ray Dvorak that if I raised the money for a real outfit, that we continue this as a tradition. Ray gave me permission to do so, but this was 1929. The Depression was on. I went from sorority to fraternities. I had a lot of bean meals, but very little money. I think, as I recollect, I raised around $34 for this outfit, but I wasn't about to quit. Now, Robert Drake was a Scott executive of Champaign-Urbana and a very good friend of mine. And he had suggested quite some time before that Isaac Coon, who had the Coon clothing store, was interested not only in the band but in the university and was a loyal supporter of the university. He told me that he might. I remembered this, and so I went to Isaac Coon or Joseph Coon, one of the two. I can't remember which, Isaac or Joseph, and told him my idea of perpetuating the tradition, but to have a kingdom and a king, you've got to have a crown to pass down to keep it alive, and a scepter to pass down. In other words, the war bonnet and the regalia was necessary to maintain tradition. So I told him I would go out to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota at Kadoka. When I got out there, it was just a little place, a filling station, a trading post, a store or two, and an Indian agent's house, as I recollect. And I told Coon that if he would provide the money, that I would go out there and see that there was a genuine war suit made in the old way. He said for me to come back in a week or so and he'd think about it. When I returned to see him, he said, "Yes, I will. I'll support you up to $500 if you go out and personally see that that's the right thing." So I took letters of introduction from Ray Dvorak and Professor Harding and from Coons, representing, of course, the funding and the university, and took them out and turned them over to the Indian agent at the Pine Ridge Reservation. I don't remember his name. I have it written down somewhere. And he called in an Indian trader there and told him what I wanted. They, in turn, called in an old Indian woman who spoke no English and told her what I wanted, and she agreed to superintend the making of a war suit in the old way. Now, this was in August of 1929. Now, in the summer of 1920, I had a peace pipe, a real calumet peace pipe from my own family. And that summer, the Boy Scout Jamboree was being held in Arrow Park in England. And I led the Boy Scout troop from here over there. And I took a teepee. I had the boys make up Indian outfits. Of course, they weren't eagle feathers and the like and so on. But they were simulated and all that. And the teepee was made in the old way. And I took the peace pipe. The reason I mention that is I gave it later on to the University of Illinois for the use of the chief of line, like where it subsequently disappeared, I understand, was stolen. Anyway, that peace pipe, the Prince of Wales, came into our teepee, and smoked the peace pipe.
Mm.
And then invited me and another friend of mine to the lodge at Arrow Park near Liverpool. So I was a guest at Prince of Wales one afternoon at Arrow Park. Either the Duke of Connaught or the Duke of Gloucester, I don't remember which now, smoked a pipe apiece when he was visiting the American contingent. He was the one that opened, along with Lord Baden-Powell, the jamboree. When I returned home, I think I'm getting a year or so mixed up here, but I'm a little uncertain.
Excuse me, were you, the Boy Scout jamboree was after you were at the university or during
well,
the
Well, I was during the university,
during the
yes,
university
the summer.
Okay, fine.
But you see, when I went out to the Pine Ridge Reservation, I stayed there from August, the 1st of August to about the 1st of September when I had to come back to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
But the uniform, the outfit was not ready.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact I had designated that it had to be genuine.
Mm-hmm.
They had to get the tail feathers of bald eagles, still eagle now. But I designated they were to have 102 tail feathers, eagle feathers.
Mm.
The reason I picked 102 was because that was the number of feathers in the war bonnet of Red Cloud, the war chief during the Civil War period of the Oglala clan of the Sioux.
Mm.
They took 22 deer, male deer, to make the breastplate. All of the beadwork was done in the old-fashioned. The tanning of the buckskin was done in the old-fashioned, and the beadwork. The war bonnet had a spirit feather with a medicine bundle tied to it. That has disappeared, I understand, too. There was a bear claw necklace, grizzly bear claw necklace. That has disappeared.
Oh.
The war club that belonged to us, my family, it disappeared also. However, all the rest of the outfit was to say it was used by all the chief Illiniwek from 1930. From 1930, when I first wore it, leading the Illinois band down Fifth Avenue when we played Army in Yankee Stadium.
Mm. How exciting.
And I wore it in 1930 and 1931. At the Army Illinois game, it came in time for the Army Illinois game of that year.
Mm-hmm.
They brought the Army mule from West Point to the Yankee Stadium. Two cadets, and I have movies of this, by the way, two cadets got on the mule, and that mule tossed them off in front of 70,000-80,000 people. So I took off the war bonnet, and I got on the mule, and I rode that mule down the field. It didn't throw me off. But since I had taken care of horses from the time, as long as I can remember, I don't even remember learning to ride. I've ridden from the time I can remember. So I was able to ride the mule without getting tossed off on my head.
And Illinois won the game?
I'm sorry to say we lost the game.
Too bad. But
yes,
you won that contest.
I won the mule.
You won the mule.
Anyway, I have movies of this whole trip. Ray DeVore dancing. He was in a train wreck later on and had one of his legs, I think, cut off, and one of his arms cut off, and then he became the leader of the Wisconsin band, University of Wisconsin band. And I've met him at several of the reunions lately, and I have movies of Ray Dvorak as a young man dancing on the edge of Niagara Falls when we were going through, risking his neck without any doubt. All you got to do is look at the movie to see he was taking a chance. Also, all other affairs.
Now, when they choose someone to wear the suit, it has to be the right size person.
No, not necessarily, but they get a big guy. I made the rules, and most of them are still being obeyed, I hope, how to become a chief of line away. It's been now over 50 years, so I guess it's here to stay. I hope so.
This is about the 50th anniversary.
Well, let me see. About 28 was the idea.
When you first started.
Now when I was at the Indian Reservation, see, I lived in a teepee right with an Indian family, and the teepee I lived in, the guy, fellow's name, I forget how he pronounced it Indian wise, but it meant guards alone, as I remember.
Meant what?
Guards alone.
Guards alone.
Yeah. Now, before I left for home. Now, the suit wasn't finished at that time. They had to send it to me. But before I left for home, I was taken in to, formally taken in to the Oglala clan of the Sioux. They passed the pipe, smoked it to the earth, the sky, the earth, and the directions from hand to hand. They washed my hands and arms and declared I was a... member of the Oglala clan of the Sioux. Let's see what else. Well, I lived right in a teepee, and I certainly know how they operate and why. I think they're the finest tent to live in you can find. Actually, it's a double tent. There's an inside tent, and the air, no matter from which direction the air comes from, it'll hit and go up. And you live, I suppose you'd say you live in the chimney when you live in a teepee, because the air...
It was comfortable.
Oh, yes. The air goes up between the inner and outer cover that's on the poles.
How did they treat you?
Fine. I had a fine time. I enjoyed it. And I've attended several of the Indian dances, social dance, and one thing or another. I think what I will do is go back to the Indian reservation. Thinking it over, I realize I did not put in a few things I should have put in. The Indian chief that was at the Oglala reservation was named Black Elk. As I understand it, his father was one of the lesser war chiefs under Crazy Horse, who led the attack on Custer and the 7th Cavalry, where the 7th Cavalry was decimated in the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Now, in relation to the family that I lived with, He Who Guards Alone, or something like that, is a translation of the name. I don't remember the Indian name anymore. But he had, of course, his wife and a grandfather, whether it was the father of the wife or the son, I don't know. But the warrior, that is, he who guards alone, his bed was at the rear of the teepee. Now, the teepee is about 16 feet or thereabouts, maybe 18 feet across. And the bed was on two sort of small logs with but across these logs were two saplings, and across them counter to the saplings were much smaller twigs laid across, or like they made sort of a bed, and over on that was blankets to make the bed. Now, he had hanging from the teepee poles that went as high, went a little bit higher than the in than the interior canvas backing of the tent. He had some leather thongs over which from which hung a rifle case with a Winchester rifle. Now his father, or the grandfather that lived in the tent with us, was, I suppose, what you call a blanket Indian. Every night he would strip naked and roll himself up in a blanket on the on another simmer bed as his son or son-in-law. And the thing that always struck me, and it was interesting to me, he always rolled himself up with a tomahawk. And why he would do this, I don't know, except it was just a case of an attack, perhaps. Now, he spoke no English, so I was unable to converse with him. But I was told that he had been, as a young man, one of the warriors that had ridden with the Sioux against against the whites on war parties, and also had been at the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Did was there any other family there? The wife or anybody lived
yes,
in
the
tent?
Yes, the wife. Sure, the wife. Sure, the wife lived in the tent,
right.
and the son lived in the tent, in the teepee, rather, I shouldn't say tent. I think that would. I want to go back on the Macon County school system. You see, long ago, generally, various farmers with land would donate an acre to put the country schools on. For example, my grandfather, Andrew Bowman, donated 1 acre for a school that became known as the Blue Door School. Now, it's no longer existent, of course, but the name of the, it was a log school, log cabin school, and they made a door for it, and just happened, my grandfather had part of a bucket of blue paint, and so they painted the door, and it got the name of Blue Door School. Now, I had all of my aunts, you see, I had 6 aunts. Every one of them was a school teacher before 1902 in the country schools of Macon County. Of course, since there were 6 of them and they taught all over the county, I know my mother taught for 16 years before she was married. Many of them started to teach rather young in the Macon County, well, all school systems, I suspect. But that gave a tremendous advantage with the knowledge of so many people over such a large area. For example, at Oriana and Long Creek. One of my aunts taught at Long Creek, another at in the Macon area, Blue Mound area, the Moroa area, and some of the schools, I don't know the names of them anymore, but they've disappeared, and the names I don't remember. But I do know that a total of 56 years were taught by my aunts in Macon County. At that time, they, since there were so many of them, they practically educated or very prominent in the education of the people and the young people of Macon County outside the city of Decatur. So when my Aunt Leona, that I have already mentioned and told about, ran for office, that was a tremendous advantage because the Bowman sisters were very well known in the county as teachers and as a family. Therefore, it aided my father, my great uncle, who were interested in politics, to help get her elected for this county superintendent of schools in 1906. I'd like to tell one instance, minor, of course, but my mother made a big impression on my mother. She was teaching at the time at the Kirby School.
Where is that?
The Kirby School is southeast of Oriana. And she was teaching there, and she was staying with the Kirby family. I think they're gone now, but their farm and the old barn is still out there. I've driven by it not too long ago just to look at it. And the Kirby family and our own family, Bowman and Borchers, all were great friends. The Kirbys had some sons, and though they lived quite a ways from Decatur, they used to come to this house here and played pinochle with my father and some of his Decatur friends.
It wasn't so easy to come to Decatur in those days.
No, it was. Well, later on they had cars.
Right.
They were very well-to-do. Right. Had a good deal of land, and it was easy. From the, after they got cars, had been the horse and buggy, I don't know whether they would come in so much, but certainly before World War, during the period of World War I, or shortly before it, they had cars and were able to come in. Well, my mother would stay the week, as the custom was, with a farming family in the school district. Mm-hmm. And this particular weekend, there had been some heavy rains on the Sangamon River. Now, the Coulter's Mill is where the Coulter's Road is, no longer a bridge there. At that time, this was before the bridge. But I think the Coulter, I think his name was John Coulter, but I've rather forgotten the story. I've heard it in the past so long ago, I don't remember the names for sure. But the river came up through the heavy rains, and my mother was going home to our own farm on the Sangamon River.
How did she travel?
Horse and buggy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it was dark and in the spring, and she and John Coulter wasn't sure that she realized the river was up, because you had to ford the river.
So
he was watching for her with a lantern, and when he heard the horse coming down the hill towards the from the north to the cross the ford at the Sangamon River at the Coulter ford where the mill was, he waved the lantern and yelled. They called my mother's name was Alice. He yelled, "Allie, Allie, don't come down. Turn back, turn back. The river's up. You can't. It's too high. You'll get drowned if you do." So she stopped short. She heard him and saw him. It was quite a little distance across the flood, and so she returned. Of course, stayed with the Kirbys during the weekend, and I suppose then in the following week she then was able to go home.
Well, he saved her an accident
or possibly
maybe her
drowning.
Life.
Now, there was another time at Coulter's Mill. It was a custom of the people to have picnics at a wooded area at Coulter's Mill on the north side of the Sangamon. And they would have picnics and come from all over. And one summer there was quite a picnic on Sunday. And my father had taken my mother to the picnic before they were married. Mm-hmm. And when he was there, my father was very, very active and very strong. There was a guest from Chicago with one of the families who was a boxer. He wanted to box, so everybody encouraged my father to box, and he finally said, "All right," and he won the fight. Now, I might tell about another time about the Sangamon baseball team, Sangamon Oakley baseball team, and that was that on a day in this particular spring, this was before my father was married and my Uncle Ed was married, Uncle Ed Borchers were married, and let's see, there were probably some of the Shambaughs and the Heisers were there. They had formed a baseball team. There was quite a big game being played between Decatur and St. Louis in Oakland Park. That's where Millikan University is now. And so they took the borrowed a hand car. One of the boys worked for the Wabash Railroad. They borrowed a hand car, the team did, and hand carred in to Decatur, crossed the river, and went around to Oakland Park, where they set the hand car off the tracks. And they waited for the St. Louis team to come on, and there were many people from Decatur out to watch the game in Oakland Park. I might tell you, we have in the family records, we still have the original newspaper clipping about this event.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the St. Louis team didn't turn up. So the Decatur team insisted that they play the Sangamon team, Sangamon Oakley team, who they felt they were going to just beat, pound the devil out of them. And the Sangamon Oakley team finally said, "Okay, so the people have something, a game to watch, we will play." But the umpire was from Decatur, and things didn't go according to what the Oakley Sangamon team liked. They were beating the Decatur team, the Sangamon, the Decatur umpire was leaning very heavily in the direction of the Decatur team. And it was so noticeable that they got very angry about it. And it turned into a free-for-all fight. Mm-hmm. Well, someone called the police who began to gallop out in the Black Mariah they had mm-hmm. at that time come out West Main Street to where the Oakland Park was. Well, of course, the news got around. They called the police, and they had the baseball bats, and the Oakley Sangamon team put the hand car back on the rails, and with my Uncle Ed Borchers and George Fisher with baseball bats holding off the Decatur people and the Decatur team swinging at them so they couldn't, until they got started, they finally got the hand car going at a good clip, and it's about the same time the Black Mariah came with the police, and they galloped alongside the track trying to catch up to arrest the Sangamon Oakley team, but they never made it. They headed off and were able to return to the Oakley area without the Decatur police stopping them. Of course, my father at that time didn't realize he had become a resident later on and then mayor of Decatur. Long ago, they used to have dances. I've heard my father, of course, tell these stories. They were very proud of some of these things. Their young man escapades. Mm-hmm. So my Uncle Ed Borchers and my father and another brother, George Borchers, all from Oakley Township, used to attend the dances in the schools. They would have weekend dances. And they were thought themselves pretty tough.